Are we recording? No, too much.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Ducks Watch Together. I'm Josh.
And I'm Kylie.
And on today's episode, we talk about To Kill a Mockingbird.
Here we go. We're going to talk about one of my favorite book adaptations onto film. Because every summer, I read To Kill a Mockingbird, and then I usually end up watching the movie because I have a habit of when I read a book, I then go watch the movie. Or conversely, I'll watch the movie and then go read the book.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the book Interstellar is based on.
Kylie. It's a good reason. Good call there. Why are we doing this list?
Why are you looking at my letterboxed?
I'm getting to your 100. Let's see if this is on there.
It is. It's like number 49-ish. It's going to be in this column. Keep going.
55.
You're like, Spider-Man 2 was...
not quite as good as The Sixth Sense.
Fine, I'll go change it.
You have to change it.
I have to change it. I feel... I need to go back through and take another look at this list.
You also have a little Pulp Fiction, which as we found out earlier, you'd be like, I might watch McFarland USA over that.
You're right. Alright, so Pulp Fiction. Let's keep moving Pulp Fiction down. Pulp Fiction will go right there.
I feel like, so Kylie recently made her 100 list.
That's a real hard list.
It's a really hard list to do because I will say that what I ran into when I first started doing this, so I've been keeping track of my 100 films for almost a decade-ish now at this point, maybe a little shy of that. I started keeping track of my list. And it evolves over time. There are films that fall in, there are films that fall out, and definitely, like, for me, the tops are very stable, and there are certain films that will never leave. But I feel like what happens when you're doing it for the first time is that your list becomes, like, there's films like Pulp Fiction where you're like, I know this is a good movie. It's a great movie, and I really genuinely love it.
Mm-hmm.
But do you have an emotional connection to it? Or is it just there because it's a great movie and you want to say it's on your list?
And it's also one of those films where, like, I do enjoy watching it.
Yeah, but
But, like, it's also, I mean, so I just, probably at the end of the year, I'll go back through and start looking at the films I saw this year. And so, like, something like Schindler's List will probably be put onto this list. But, like, if you were, like, Kylie, Schindler's List or Pulp Fiction. I loved Schindler's List, but it's such... The material of it is just so disheartening to watch that I would probably end up... I wouldn't want to watch it as much as I would Pulp Fiction, but...
Which is why this list is an exercise of favorite movies is so hard, because mm-hmm. you have to say, are you categorizing them as best movies? Are you categorizing them as ones you would watch? But, like, if you were sitting down to watch a movie and you had all 100 of these options, this is the order you'd want to watch them in?
Because I will say that for sure, probably the top 20, I know at the very least, are ranked in, these are my favorite films in this order.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And then after that, it starts to get a little bit muddled.
Which I think is, that's just as taste kind of goes and stuff like that. And so that 100 list is really interesting to kind of put together as a cinematic journey, you know, stuff like that. And I know with mine, I've had some things break into my top 20 recently. But, yeah. Because, like, Moonlight is in my top 20. My top 10 hasn't changed since 2013. I added Snowpiercer. Yeah, I love Snowpiercer.
And I know that, like, every time that I rewatch one of these films, I'm just like, man, I love this movie. And I, like, yeah. I'm like, man, I should probably put this up higher.
I know, like, over the course of my life, like, Do the Right Thing, which sits at number 17 currently, started out a little bit lower. But as I get more politically inclined and as I understand more about what it's doing, that film I just love.
Mm-hmm.
But 100 lists are really interesting because... For me, I think it's my top 25 is where I'm like, these ones are my real solid, just like, favorite films of all time, and if I could only have these films in my life, I'd just be pretty good with everything.
I remember when I finished this list and you looked at it, your comment was, this looks very much like Kylie.
Yeah, it does.
And I was like, ooh, what is that? Because I'm looking at these and I'm like, psycho, violent films.
There's just, I don't mean that it's like you. I meant that it's your taste and the things that you at least respond to. I would hope that at least my list, you could also look at it and be like, oh yeah, that's Josh.
Yeah, look at Josh's sense of humor in here.
Yeah, I have a lot of lighter films. Like, I also have Taxi Driver, so...
Looking at my top... I mean, looking at my top 10... There is one happy film in there, and it's The Sound of Music, because they escaped the Nazis. That could have easily been a darker film. And all the rest are like, death.
The darkest film in my top 10?
Is Snowpiercer.
Yeah.
There's a whole scene about eating babies.
Yeah. I got one, two, three technical children's films.
Prisoner of Azkaban is...
I don't think it is, but people just lump the Harry Potter in there.
It's darker.
Yeah.
It's a darker...
Yeah.
It's one of the darker Harry Potter films, and a darker kids movie.
I've got two...
I mean, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is also, like,
yeah,
depressing in that self-reflection of our own existence sort of thing, but it ends on a... There are glimpses of hope within it.
Nice. Hey, we'll attach our top 100 list to this episode so you guys can go see them. I think we already done that at one point. Hey, let's do this. As we've been talking about top 100s, let's do that as our inquiry of the half fortnight.
Okay.
Friends, if you had to...
What are your top 100 movies?
What are your top 100 movies? Just list them out right there.
And we'll do an entire episode on you. And we'll talk about each of your movies.
Yep, absolutely. Let's do this. If... let's do, maybe think of this, what are your top five? And really genuinely think about what your top five all-time favorite movies are. And that'll be the question, the inquiry of the half fortnight.
No.
Kylie.
Josh.
So, when we were like, hey, let's do summer movies.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, Good Burger. You were like, To Kill a Mockingbird.
We're just two very different people, and I think that if anyone looked at our top tens, they'd be like, yeah, these are two different folks.
So why is this, you're like, every summer, you gotta sit down and get sad about America.
Because, so, this journey with To Kill a Mockingbird goes back a little bit, so like... The first time I read this has to be probably 5th or 6th. It's one of the summers, and it's the summer either in between 5th and 6th or 6th and 7th, and I don't exactly remember which one, but, like, I was older than Scout, but I wasn't, like, much more mature or much older than Scout. Mm-hmm. And so I remember reading this, and as a... child, preteen-esque age, I kind of read it through the lens of which Scout tells it. And, like, you know, as a kid, I was very much like Scout. I wasn't very feminine, I wasn't very extremely girly, and, like, I saw a lot of myself at that age in Scout. And so, like, reading about a girl who was kind of, like, on the outset of what it meant to be a little girl was very entertaining. And I picked up a lot of weird habits from Scout, like, about 50-50 now, but when I was in high school, I called my mother by her first name. I did not call her Mom. Now it switches in between calling her by her first name and calling her Mom. But
that's
like,
good.
Like, I picked it up from this book.
I've always
this
wondered
movie.
Why. Like, why do they call him Atticus and not Dad?
Because he lets them, and it's kind of more like, he respects them, and so he just allows them to call him by his name. He's cool like that. My mom let me call her by her name. My father wouldn't. Dad would not. He was like, you call me Dad.
That's fair.
But my mom, I was just like, blippy blip. And so, like, this, the start of this film, or the start of the book, takes place, at the end of, takes place at the end of the story, essentially, where she's like, this was the summer where Jem broke his arm, blah, 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 blah. And so, like, it just feels like that summertime, like, and, like, there are parts of it with school, but it was mostly just taking place during the summer. And so, as when I read it the first summer, I was like, oh, this is a good book. And then I read it the second time, again in the summer, because, like, oh, I read this last summer. And then it was just a thing that I continued to do. And every time that I read it, probably up until I was, like, 18 or so, I got a different perspective of it. And it really opened my eyes as I grew up, because I was no longer reading it just from Scout's perspective, but from the perspective of looking at the United States, because in the fifth grade, I don't look at the United States as a whole. I don't understand what's going on in the world. But when I'm in high school, I start understanding, I start getting more into the news, and I start understanding the, like, what is actually being reflected in here, and, like, my knowledge of U.S. history. And so I think that it just very much changed. And my perspective of it hasn't changed much since 18 or so, but it is a very interesting thing to see how it reflects today still.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting thing too, is what it still says for America, and that it is. And I had asked you the question, and I said I was going to ask you this question of, why is this book the most read in schools? Why is it still important? Why is it still, why is it the thing, you know? And I think that you definitely see its relevance, and you definitely see its...
You know what's also strange about that is that this is also one of the most challenged books. Like, this book has been on... It's a very controversial ban book, and, like...
Why is it banned?
Even as recent as 2016, there are some Virginia schools trying to pull it off the shelf. Like, there are schools that are trying to ban this book from the library, and I think that it's just so interesting because, like, almost everyone that I know has read this book in high school.
Yeah, I read it my sophomore year, and that's when you read it.
Mm-hmm. And, like, but there, it's weird to think that in different parts of the United States, this is a banned book, just because of how important and how significant it is. Even as a kid, before I had read it, I knew that To Kill a Mockingbird was a book, and that might be the fact that we had this giant bookshelf down by the computer, and so whenever I was doing something on the computer, I could see the bookshelf. And, like, I could see all the titles that my parents owned, and they owned two copies of this book, because the first one had fallen apart, and the second one was new, and then that one fell apart because I read it 20 times.
Nice. Great. I think that kind of sets the table as to why To Kill a Mockingbird is important and what it represents, and we'll talk more about it as we get through here. So, To Kill a Mockingbird is not only a landmark film in Kylie's life, and it's a landmark film in Hollywood as well, too. The film sees Gregory Peck win an Oscar for his Best Actor performance, as well as it wins two more, one for art direction, which is, like, production design, and one for screenplay, for adapting from Harper Lee's source material. And I think that the film holds up and really creates this uniquely male character that is male and is very much a man, but also is not the, like, man's man kind of dude.
He's not the symbol of masculinity.
Yes, and I think that that's something that is something that's always endeared me specifically to Atticus Finch. And I will say that I've read the book once. I read it in high school, and I very much enjoyed it. I think that, to me, in comparing the book to the film, you know, a simple statement that I will make is that I think the book does more justice to the Boo Radley storyline, mm-hmm. and I think the film does more justice to the Atticus Finch storyline. And I think that's just, in terms of the film, that's the story they wanted to tell. They wanted to tell that story and make Atticus Finch be really kind of epic hero and this almost unrealistic father figure that everyone wants in their lives, you know.
And this film succeeds on that. I mean, so AFI has their list of 100 villains and heroes in film, and Atticus Finch is number one. He is the number one hero in film, and I think that Gregory Peck and the way that it presents the trial is just so well done that it makes him the strong character. And I mean, he is the symbol of a hero without having to be that masculine symbol. Number two on that list is Indiana Jones, who I think is a very opposite character, where yeah. Indiana Jones is a symbol of masculinity.
Yeah, he's very masculine in every way and every shape and form of what he is, in terms of how he treats others, how he treats women, how he treats his co-workers and his people below him. And then there's Atticus, who's just the very opposite character. I think what's interesting is, at least for me, and I will say that I think maybe for most people, when we're younger, for most men, I'll say men, when we're younger and we're kind of like teens and 20s and we want to be cool and hip, and I think we want to be Indiana Jones. I think that he's more of a thing that we can strive for, and that we're like, yeah, we want to be that cool adventurer.
We want to be like Indiana Jones and Han Solo.
But as I grow up and as I realize more of like what I want to be as a man and what I think we need more in this world of masculinity, I want to be Gregory Peck in this film, you know, and I want to be that natured, that he's very even-handed. He never really loses his cool in this film. He's a good father. He cares about his children. He cares about their problems. I love the scene where it's Scout's first day of school. I think it's just, that's a beautiful scene, and he doesn't do a ton in it outside of, you know, the general like, eat your breakfast, come sit down. He's just giving the commands that a very patient father would give, and it's still just a beautiful scene. And then when they're running back and forth because they're so excited because they forgot their books or they forgot this, and they have to run in and out the door 3 or 4 times, and he just smiles and laughs and is like, all right, here we go. And I think then to compare and contrast that with, I think another scene that is so beautiful is that, so early in the film, Jem wants to get a gun. That's all he wants. He wants to get a gun. And his father said he didn't get one until he was 13 or 14, and Jem's not going to get one until he's that old at the very least. And then there's a scene with his dog that Atticus has to put down, and Jem's just blown away because I think it's the sheriff that's like, yeah, didn't you know your father's the best shot in town?
And in that scene, like, I mean, that is so... being able to fire a gun, in a sense, is a very masculine trait, and it's a very, like, high-honored masculine trait of being good with a gun. And Atticus, while he is a great shot, he doesn't revert to that unless he absolutely has to.
Yeah.
His biggest weapon is logic and his words and respect for other people.
And I think that's one of the things that makes Atticus this outstanding hero and this outstanding human, is because he has all the qualities of Indiana Jones, but he doesn't want to show you them. He wants to show you his more manly qualities, and that he can be smarter, and that he can be, he can out-talk you and out-think you, and that he is in charge of the situation. And I also love that scene with Mr. Cunningham, who he's like, well, he pays me in food of some kind, I think. I don't remember what the swap is at the very beginning of the film. He pays him with something.
It's like water chestnuts, yes, or something.
Yeah. And Scout's like, why isn't he giving you money? He's like, well, this is what he can afford, and that's fine. You know? And then when we see him be strong in that courtroom scene, and he holds his own, and I think there's a really interesting thing that speaks to the duality of the time in America and within Atticus Finch. And so there's that moment in the courtroom where Atticus is defending Tom, and he's saying, I think it's his closing speech, and part of his closing speech, he says something along the lines of that Tom committed like one of the most cardinal sins in American society, and he's very clear to say that it's American society, not in his belief, but in American society, that he kissed a white woman, and that he's still, even being the great upstanding moralistic human that he is, he still is like, I understand that in society, a black man and a white woman cannot be together. And he's saying, but don't punish him because that's not against the law. You know, and it's just really interesting to watch how this character's conflicted morals kind of come to the light, because he's a very moralistic person. He's very much against, like, justice for all men, you know? And it would be interesting to and I say it's interesting, but I know Ghost at a Watchman exists, but to explore Atticus's morals even more than what it is, because he is a man who lives, and I don't know the era, it's the Depression era, right? Mm-hmm. In the South. And so, yeah, there's a huge racial divide there. So to watch Atticus defend a man who we do not know his personal opinions on, but that doesn't matter to him. The law is what matters to him. The justice for this person who didn't do anything is what matters for him. Everybody should be created equal, which he passes on.
And I mean, Atticus doesn't know too much about the case when he takes it, because he's literally sitting on the porch and the judge comes up and he's like, Tom Robinson is going to be tried for this and we need a lawyer. And he's like, I'm going to do this. And like, the judge is even like, I know you have your kids that you have the... you have to spend a lot of time with, and he's still like, this is what's important. He knows it's
the right thing to do.
And also, like, what kind of person is he going to be? How can he continue to be a father to his children if he is not willing to do this?
And something that I just love about his performance in this character is he's very firm with his kids, but he's not mean. Mm-hmm. And I very much appreciate that. And to show, you know, one of the only other father figures that we get to see in the film is Mr. Ewing? The dad of the girl who is accusing Tom. I know it starts with an E. I just can't remember his last name per se. We get to see him as a terrible father who beats and abuses his daughter, and then tries to come kill Jem and Scout. I mean, I guess spoilers for To Kill a Mockingbird, but I mean, if you've not read it or seen it,
we're gonna spoil this.
Yeah. So it's interesting to watch how fatherhood is really portrayed in this film as well.
And I mean, so one of the famous lines that's cut from this movie is, she's talking to her grumpy neighbor, Scout is talking to the grumpy neighbor, and then her neighbor says something along the lines of, I mean, he's different behind closed doors, which means that she's questioning if Atticus is the same person in society, in the public, as he is behind closed doors. And she's like, our dad's the same behind closed doors. And I think that's very apparent in this film without having to say that.
Yeah.
The way that he treats his children is how he treats other people, and how, like, he is public about his respect for everyone else.
I also love that scene where he takes the Cunningham boy and lets him come in and is like, here, eat my food, eat this roast. We're not gonna mock you for putting syrup all over your food. Like, you know, it's really interesting.
I mean, Calpurnia is the one that has to be like, Scout, you're gonna eat in this kitchen if you don't mind yourself.
I mean, fair, but he also was, you know, it takes two.
Scout.
Yeah. And I think that at that time, like, that knowing that, like, because the film will talk about gender politics not a lot, but a little bit in that situation where the Calpurnia's role is almost a motherly role since the mother's not in the picture. And so he did the fatherly role, and then Calpurnia stepped up and did the motherly thing where she took him away and said, no, you're going to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that we've commented that this is a really good adaptation of the book.
I mean, I think so.
So what makes a good adaptation? I think that it's following a lot of the same themes of the book, and it's telling the story. And yes, it does change the focus a little bit. Now, Boo Radley in the book is much more of a significant character in the fact that he's talked about a lot more, and we see Scout and Jem just trying to find him and talking about him, and the thing about the inside of the tree is much more significant in the book. But in the film, they start out, Boo Radley, And then when the trial happens, it's Tom Robinson's trial, and then at the end they bring in Boot Radley again. But I don't think that it hurts the film.
The film has to do this thing where it's gotta
make a choice.
Balance it. Well, because so it's harder to balance. In a book, you're telling the book from Scout's point of view. So it's easier for the narrator to be like, oh,
Boot this Radley's trial important.
Was going on, but I was always thinking about Boot Radley.
Mm-hmm.
The filmmaker... Robert Mulligan and the screenwriter Horton Foote decide that we're going to tell this as Scout as the narrator, but it's not going to be solely from her point of view. It is from her point of view, that is who we're seeing, but she spends so long at this trial, and this trial takes so much there, that they have to put in that line of narration where she says after they find the soap dolls and he shows her all the things that he's been finding... She has to say that line of narration where it's, and that was the last time we heard from Boo Radley for a while, because the film knows we're going to go to the court for a real long time in terms of the film's running time. Because I believe we spend 30 to 45 minutes in that courtroom scene, which is a third or so of the film. Mm-hmm. And whereas with the book, we can kind of... even though it's probably a chapter, or is it, how long is the trial in the book? Is it a whole chapter? Is it a chapter?
It's probably a chapter or two. Yeah, I think it's two chapters.
It's two chapters, but in that thing, we've got so much of it there that when we stop for two chapters, it's not like we're really stopping for as long of a time. So that's why it does, I think, the Boo Radley stuff feels just slightly disjointed. And if it wasn't for Robert Duvall's performance, and this is Robert Duvall's first ever performance, and he gets no speaking lines, but he gives this really subtle, sweet, tender performance. And if it wasn't for that, the Boo Radley stuff really wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Because we only see him at the very end, which is good. That's the point. That's good. And when we do see him, we have to know that that's an innocent man, and that is a sweet, kind man. You know, like, that is a man who could be friends with Scout.
Mm-hmm. And I do think that it's also Gregory Peck's performance of Atticus Finch taking that very famous character and putting it on screen makes it very good. I also like Mary Badham as Scout in this. I know that...
I don't love her, but I don't hate her. Like, I think she plays a very, very honest kid.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is something that's really hard to do, so that's good. She just, much like I said with Christian Bale in Empire of the Sun, I think she's just a kid being a kid. And I don't think she's given any real heavy lifting to do other than just to react to things. I think she does a very, very good job of that. And there are times where maybe I'm just annoyed with the Scout character and I'm blaming it on Mary Badham, which could very well be a true story. But definitely, when we spend a lot of time with her, especially in the early parts of her going to school and stuff, I'm just like, goodness, child, get it together. Like...
I mean...
And I was confused, too, if she was supposed to be, like, 5 years old or how old she's supposed to be at the beginning of the story, because she says it's her first day of school, which to me says kindergarten and five, but I don't know if that's true of the time period.
She's, like...
She looks older.
She's supposed to be eight, and so, like, they went to school later mm-hmm. in those days.
Yeah.
I think that... the way that she was casted and the way that Jem was casted was essentially they went to where they filmed this, as far as my understanding, and they got two local kids.
Right.
And that's where Jem and Scout are from. And I think that they're both... They have a natural sense to them. And I don't think, as you're saying, they are kids being kids, which that allow... That's okay, because Gregory Peck's the one that's supposed to be doing the heavy lifting in this, because... I keep calling her Jean Louise, and she's really Scout.
I mean,
that is her real name.
Yeah.
I think that Scout, especially in the book, she is the narrator, and things happen to her, but she doesn't carry the action. Atticus Finch is the one that carries the action, and he's the one that carries the action in this film.
Yeah, this is his film by any means. Not that I would give either of the kids... Like, so she gets a supporting actress nomination. Not that I would give either of the kids an acting nomination for this film. But I think Jem's really interesting to me because he has to grow up, and this is his coming of age story in a lot of ways, when realizing what his father is doing and why his father is doing it. And I think that's an element of the film that works really, really well. And I believe it's in the book too. I think mm-hmm. that's absolutely there. And that's what I love with this story, is it actually tells like these three really beautiful stories with Atticus, Scout, and Jem, and they all kind of mix together as this family growing and changing. And I think that's what's really, really beautiful about the story itself.
And I mean, it is about both of them having to grow up, but it's also about Jem having to determine what it means to be a man and realizing that having a gun isn't what's going to make him a man. Being like his father is what's going to make him like a man.
And he's got to understand that where he's at, he's around a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of ignorant people in this movie. There's a lot of ignorant people in his town. And he has to understand that the majority of his voice and of the voice of the town and the loudest voices in the town are of the ignorant folk. But he has to rise above it, which to me is such a beautiful moral of this film, is that Jem represents what a lot of people have to go through, is you have to be this, you have to sift through all the bunk and the hate and the fear and the racism and the sexism and the homophobia, and you have to be smarter than that, and you have to rise above it, you know? You have to look at a human for being a human. And they are nothing more than that until they, I don't know, break the law. And I know that the law isn't always, like, you know, the law isn't perfect. But whatever moralistic law you have, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know. It's just, it's a really sticky situation. But he, Jem, represents so much of us trying to figure out who we are as humans, you know. So yeah, I think there's that scene for me which really sells it, is it's after the case and he's sitting there with Scout and
Dale.
Dill?
Ooh, it might be Dill.
I think it's Dill.
I always call him Dale.
Dill.
It is Dill. Charles Baker.
Yes, with Dill, who is based upon Truman Capote, which I really find that was an interesting fact.
Really?
Yeah, so Harper Lee, like, Scout is Harper Lee.
Uh-huh.
And Dill is Truman Capote. They, like, that's a thing. They were friends when they were younger. And so she based that character off of Truman Capote.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah. And then Truman Capote grows up to be the In Cold Blood author and is a really interesting person himself.
I just know that I'm kind of weary about Truman Capote.
How so?
Like, In Cold Blood is one of those books where I'm like, ooh, okay.
Right? Well, I think he's a really fascinating character, and, mm-hmm. and it's explored really well in Capote. But anyway, so Jem is sitting there with those two on the porch, and he's got his head down, head down, head down. And his father comes home, and he listens to what he has to say when he tells him that Tom has died. And then he decides. He's like, I'm going to go with my father. I'm going to be his backup. And I think that's such a big moment to the point where he says it once and Atticus is like, no, you're going to stay here. And then he says it twice and he just says it to him in that way where Atticus knows, no, he's going to come with me. Like, he's going to be my backup, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm. Or he's at least going to be there.
Yeah. Mary Badham only has 6 acting credits. To Kill a Mockingbird is the first one.
Mm-hmm.
A TV series called Dr. Kildare.
Great.
An episode of The Twilight Zone.
Okay.
A movie called The Property is Condemned.
Mm-hmm.
Let's Kill Uncle, another movie. And all of that is from 62 to 66. And their last credit comes in 2005 in a film called Our Very Own.
She's been in a couple of documentaries where she plays herself.
Right.
But one of them is on a documentary called About to Kill a Mockingbird, and the other one's Earl Hammer Storyteller. I don't know what that is.
Oh, neither. I will say one of the, I think, the more underrated elements of this film, because I was trying to find, like, what's a unique take on To Kill a Mockingbird, because To Kill a Mockingbird is a cinematic classic. There's nothing real. I mean, there are some little things here and there that kind of you can knock it down for, but on the whole, it works so emotionally well, and it's just a well-scripted, well-shot. It's beautifully shot. I think it shows the South in a really beautiful, interesting way. I was showing it. It's terrifying, but also the kind of fairy-talistic quality and the simplistic nature of the early, of that period of the South. And then to me, you can also tell there's a lot of influence by the cinematographer from, I believe that to me, the cinematographer is inspired by Night of the Hunter a lot in the way that he frames the South and films the South and gives it this kind of majestic, I think there's a kind of fairy tale quality to this story in the way that it's shot, in the terms of it presents an idyllic South in all of its problems, you know? And though it's not as dark and specifically noir as Night of the Hunter is, I think that this film takes a lot of its cues on how to show the South from that film and from a lot of different other ways. Because even when bad things are happening in the film, you've always got the sense of it is still almost a for lack of a better word, like I said, a fairy tale-ish kind of version of it.
Because we do have our knight that is trying to undo all the justice within the world.
The injustice within the world, yeah. One of, I think, the most underrated things that is in this film is Brock Peters. And Brock Peters plays Tom. And I think the reason that courtroom scene holds so strong is because of the performances of each of the witnesses on the stand. And I think that they all do a good job in that we see. Because Gregory Peck needs somebody to bounce off of. And to me, the one that is the most heartbreaking, the most wrenching is Brock Peters. He's got two moments that are just outstanding to me. And the first one is the moment where Atticus asks him to stand and he reveals that his left hand was crushed and so he can't use his left hand. And then the second one is where he says, I didn't do it, sir, or whatever that line is there. And I think both those are so very powerful. And how Brock Peters didn't end up with an Oscar nomination from this film is beyond me. Because I think that he sells so much of what works. And I'm just imagining, you know, even in the 60s when the Civil Rights Movement is happening, a film like this comes out and you're going to need the person playing Tom to really be spot on with everything that he's doing in order to get everybody behind him. And he just is. And he's always one of my favorite parts of this film. And I love to shout him out as a great part of this film too. AFI, which has their 100 films of all time list, has this at 25. Right above Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and below E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
I think Atticus Finch is listed as the second best fictional character on some really important list.
I mean, he is, like,
underneath, which I disagree with both of these. The first one being Jay Gatsby, and the second one being Holden Caulfield. Holden's one of those ones where it's very important to growing up, but I think that, sure, have Holden be pretty close to the top, but I don't think he's the second best ever.
So Atticus is third behind them?
Yes.
Interesting. Gatsby's interesting to me, because I don't ever find Gatsby to be a real interesting character himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, Gatsby's character has been done so much better in other things, like Willy Loman. Like, Willy Loman is a much more compelling version of the Great Gatsby. Anyways, we're not talking about Great Gatsby.
Sorry, yeah, well. but yeah, no, Atticus to me is the America that we need. And he's the America that I think, the reason to me that To Kill a Mockingbird is still held up over, because this is a subject that is well-worn and well in literature and in film, and it's been talked about a lot. And Atticus Finch is the reason why I think that the film is as successful as it is and the story is as resonant as it is. I know we've just gushed about Atticus, but there's, I mean, you can listen to other podcasts and read other reviews and watch the film itself. That's what I would say. If you've not watched this movie, watch this movie. And if for some reason you've not read the book, read the book. But Atticus, I think, is the thing that holds us up. And, yeah. Question for you.
Answer.
In the end of this film, near the end of this film, when they're going home and they get attacked, she's in a ham costume. Which is funny. Is that in the book? I don't remember it. Oh, okay. Great. Cool. I just didn't know if that was some, like, silly visual that the...
That's a stupid thing, but, like...
I mean, it makes sense. No, it works in the film.
That she... And it
works in the book.
It enables her from being able to escape even further.
Mm-hmm.
So, essentially, that is the scene that causes Jem to, like, stand up and be a man for the first time.
Yes.
And it stops Scout from being able to
help. Because we know she would be somebody who would be in that fight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Any final thoughts? Anything else you want to say about To Kill a Mockingbird, Kylie?
I think that it's a sin to kill a mockingbird, because all a mockingbird wants to do is sing a song.
Solid metaphor there. Solid metaphor. All right, you guys, if you want to join this conversation, and you should want to because it's an important conversation, you can do so at our website at friendandfriendpodcast.squarespace.com. You can also do so on Facebook at Friend and Friend Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at...
DWTS_podcast.
YouTube.
Ducks Watch Together.
Tumblr.
Ducks Watch Together.
Letterboxd.
DerbyACT and Kylie Galsher.
And finally, and most importantly, you can find us on Apple Podcasts and iTunes, where you can subscribe and leave us 5-star reviews and help get us out there. Thank you so much for listening. This has been a really fun episode. I've been Josh.
Kylie.
Quack, 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 quack.